Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On March 3rd, 2021, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Carr v. Saul, a case consolidated with Davis v. Saul. The issue before the court was whether a claimant seeking disability benefits under the Social Security Act forfeits an appointments clause challenge to the appointment of an administrative law judge by failing to present that challenge during administrative proceedings. Jennifer L. Mascott, Assistant Professor of Law at the Antonin Scalia Law School of George Mason, and Professor Richard Pierce, the Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School, both join us today to discuss this case's oral argument.
Arose out of as a result of the Supreme Court's decision in 2018 in Lucia versus SEC, where the court held that administrative law judges at the Securities and Exchange Commission are inferior officers rather than employees. Now, the main consequence of that holding is that they have to be appointed by the heads of departments. In many cases, the practice was instead to appoint them for lower-level people in the agency to appoint them. That was the case at the Social Security Administration, where they had all been appointed. All 1,600 of them that existed at that time had been appointed by the head of the Human Relations Department at SSA. Immediately after the court handed down the Lucia decision, the head of the Social Security Administration ratified the appointments that had previously been made of those 1,600 administrative law judges. So the appointment then was in accordance with the Constitution. Then for purposes of this litigation, at least, the Solicitor General conceded that Lucia applies to administrative law judges at the Social Security Administration as well as at regulatory agencies. That issue has not yet been litigated anyplace. But for the purposes of this case, at least, he conceded that. So that laid the groundwork for potentially as many as 60,000 people to go to court and argue that they were entitled to new hearings before a new administrative law judge because they were the victims of an adverse decision made by an unconstitutionally appointed administrative law judge. It happened, though, that only the 60,000 comes from the fact that there's a 60-day statute of limitations, and that is the average number of cases that SSA ALJs would have would have denied benefits in. So there were potentially 60,000. There were only a few hundred cases, however, in which there actually were timely petitions for review filed in district courts. So that's those are the petitioners whose fate is subject to the decision of the court in this case. None of those few hundred had raised this issue before either the administrative law judge who originally presided in their case or the Social Security Appeals Council, who has the power to review all decisions of ALJs. And so the government argued in each of those cases that the petitioner had lost his opportunity to raise this issue on judicial review because he had not complied with the issue exhaustion doctrine. That's a doctrine that says that you cannot raise an issue on judicial review unless you have first raised it at each level in which you could raise it at the agency. That doctrine is sometimes required by statute or by agency rule, but usually it is required by common law. There are cases going back over a century in which the Supreme Court has held that issue exhaustion applies to all actions taken by agencies as a matter of common law. The doctrine is based on a lot of different considerations, the desire to avoid sandbagging by parties in agency proceedings, by discouraging them from waiting until the end of a proceeding to raise an issue, efficiency considerations by creating a legal environment in which there's only one review proceeding, and it addresses all of the issues that have been raised. Deference to both the executive and legislative branches, because this arises in contexts in which the Congress has decided that at least the initial decision-making should be done by an executive branch agency, and the opportunity for that agency then to apply its expertise in deciding the case and to exercise whatever discretion Congress has conferred on it. There have always been some exceptions to this common law doctrine. One applies in the case where exhaustion would be an exercise in futility, but the Supreme Court has interpreted that as extremely narrow and applicable only when you would be certain to lose if you were to raise the issue before the agency. And there's an exception for constitutional issues that are wholly collateral to the merits of the case before the agency. The problem with that exception is that there's a long line of cases in which the court has applied it, and an equally long line of cases in which the court has not applied it. And I just find those two lines of cases completely inconsistent. I've never been able to reconcile them. Just to look at the most recent examples on each side, Free Enterprise Fund in 2010, the court applied it. But then 2 years later in Elgin in 2012, the court didn't apply it. And I can't see any reason basis for distinction. So then there's the Sims exception, which is unique to the Social Security Administration. It's based on a Supreme Court opinion in which the court said, well, this is these SSA proceedings are more inquisitorial than adversarial. And the issue of exhaustion doctrine is attributable to the adversarial nature of our legal system. It doesn't apply the same way in the context of an inquisitorial proceeding, like a Social Security disability proceeding. The problem with that exception, a couple of problems. First, it was announced in a 414 division among the justices, where the concurring justice used very narrow reasoning and said this only applies to what would otherwise be the duty to exhaust remedies by raising an issue before the appeals council. And she reasoned that was an exception just because of the rules unique to the appeals council. So it's very difficult to figure out how the breadth of that exception. After listening to the oral argument, I think it really reinforced my prior belief that this is highly unlikely to produce any big landmark decision or even much of a spirited debate among the justices. I think the most likely outcome is 9-0 for the government, and that could be on any of four bases: issue exhaustion, application of the de facto officer doctrine, harmless error, or choice of remedies. The next most likely outcome would be 9-0 win for the petitioner, but on very, very narrow grounds, some combination of the Sims exception, but then only when the agency doesn't have any rules that govern the process of exhausting remedies. And probably in the unique context of wholly collateral constitutional issues. So that's my take on the case. And now it's over to Jennifer to see what her take is.
Thanks, Dick. Yes, I will fill in on the oral argument itself. So thank you so much for laying out all of the issues at stake. So I thought, first of all, the oral arguments themselves were just excellent. The two advocates were relatively new to the Supreme Court stage, both former Thomas clerks, and I just thought the whole discussion seemed very well prepared, seemed very comfortable. It seemed like the justices' questions got a lot of vetting. The one idiosyncratic point I would make sort of from the start is I was surprised that the justices themselves seemed to almost exclusively ask very functionalist questions, very values-driven, about efficiency, judicial economy, fairness, sandbagging. And I would have thought that there might have been some more focus on just the core question of who has the power to decide, which branch of government has the power to decide on the merits, the Appointments Clause challenge, and then also which branch of government should be deciding the exhaustion rules for the agency. And, you know, one potential analog people could have thought through comes from a wonderful article by Caleb Nelson, Adjudication in the Political Branches, which instead of just sort of comparing and contrasting from Sims and just generally looking at values with exhaustion, would instead have asked, you know, what is the category of the right or set of issues that the Social Security judges are looking at? And that article makes the point that in benefits determinations, it's a classic case that would have been left to political branches. And if that's the construct that we're in, then one might think that not only should the agency be deciding the case on the merits, but it should also have in place exhaustion rules to the extent that Congress has authorized it to do so. And I guess in that construct, maybe you would still say the petitioner prevails here because Congress has authorized judicial review of Social Security benefits determinations. And despite the Social Security Administration being put on notice after Sims that the court is going to be skeptical in places where they have not imposed an exhaustion requirement by regulation, the Social Security Administration has never clearly imposed an exhaustion requirement for raising issues that would bar the petitioners here from raising their challenge in court. Oh, another way you might think of it, though, is, well, perhaps this is slightly different because it's not just the benefits determination being adjudicated here. It is a more structural constitutional issue. And so in that case, if that's supposed to be seen as a separate challenge and claim, one might think that actually the agency indeed has no competence at all to hear that. And so there shouldn't be any possibility that the agency can adjudicate it or impose exhaustion requirements, and it should go straight to Article III court. So I think looking at it that way, probably here on the facts, the petitioner has a strong argument to prevail. The justices, as I said before, didn't really seem to be focused on that. They seemed to be focused on kind of minor distinctions or major distinctions from the Sims decision, which Professor Pierce terms as an exception to the general kind of exhaustion and waiver rule. And I guess when I go back and reread Sims, I actually see it a little bit different, the way that Justice Thomas wrote that opinion, and actually think in a certain sense it lines up with kind of the public rights or political branches approach that I'm proposing, because I read his opinion to basically be saying the default baseline here is that Congress by statute and the Social Security Administration by regulation did not impose or create exhaustion requirements. And so therefore, we don't really see that rule in place. There is this, as Professor Pierce talked about, judicial background principle of requiring exhaustion. But even if that would normally apply, certainly it shouldn't do so here, because the only reason courts are applying that is when administrative proceedings mimic the adversarial process that goes on in courts. That's not happening here at all with the Social Security Administration. Now, Justice Thomas did, in his language in the opinion, note that the case there dealt with a matter that had gone up to the Appeals Council, and so the forfeiture problem was there rather than before the ALJ, which is the kind of lower level of review that's at issue in this case. But I have a hard time actually seeing how that distinction would overcome what I read as more of the background sense, at least of where Justice Thomas was going in that initial Sims opinion, which seemed to be, again, basically saying, we don't see a statutory or regulatory basis for exhaustion. We're not going to extend it in this case. And I mean, even if the ALJ is slightly doing less adversarial things than the Appeals Council, in my view, I still think it's a far cry from kind of deep fixing the Sims precedent. A couple of things to note on Justice's specific questions or approach in the case. I mean, it does seem to me like the justices may very well have kind of made up their mind to a large degree before coming into the oral arguments, because actually the arguments, really, the round of questioning ended 10 minutes early. A couple of justices passed on asking the assistant to the SG, the government side, any questions at all, saying their questions had already been answered. And so the government advocate was left to basically be able to go back at the end and have a little bit more free time to sort of affirmatively make his case, at which point some justices broke in with additional questions. But it seemed as though it was not nearly a very contentious debate, or where the justices had, you know, more weighing on their mind than they could get into the time frame or something like that. I also thought it was interesting that Justice Kavanaugh, I mean, seemed to sort of really show his hand by asking the government attorney, assuming you lose, what do you want us to do on the remedy? The justices seemed to be asking that kind of question a lot this week. Justice Barrett asked a similar question of Mark Perry in the Arthrex case earlier in the week. So it seems like Justice Kavanaugh has a sense of where he's going. Justice Alito made an interesting point, asking a lot of questions about how on earth it could make sense to require, even if there was an appointments clause problem, why the remedy would be to give new hearings here, and what a colossal waste of money and energy and time that could be spent on adjudicating other important issues for Social Security claimants. And that point does seem reasonable to me. That said, if the court is to decide or were to think that there was a constitutional problem here and the issue were not totally forfeited, I have a hard time seeing how that concern of Justice Alito's can be reconciled with some of the language in the court's opinion in Lucia versus SEC, which, as Dick mentioned, dealt with the underlying issue of whether certain agency adjudicators are subject to the appointments clause in the first place. That, in that opinion, it was very interesting. Justice Kagan for the court did quite a good job, I think, of not reaching many issues. She really didn't break much new ground in what the meaning of an officer is. She did not want to decide for the court whether it was a problem the way that the appointments had been ratified. She did not want to decide issues on removal. But one thing that she did clearly say is that, in, at least in that case, where the constitutional violation had been properly raised before the agency, that in no uncertain terms was it was not okay for the same ALJ to rehear the case, having just had the SEC ratify that individual's appointment, that for fairness it needed to go to a new person. So that seems to be diametrically opposed with Justice Alito's instinct here. Justice Gorsuch's questions all centered on a sort of a functionalist type consideration of a 2018 notice that, interestingly, the Social Security Administration sent out to all of its adjudicators saying, you absolutely may not consider appointments clause challenges that are raised. And he seemed very concerned to know whether parties would have had awareness of this set of instructions in advance, although he didn't really tip his hand too much as to how he thought that would lead the case to come out. And then another justice who asked, I think, more functionalist questions than one might expect seemed to be Justice Barrett, who seemed concerned about wanting to know how many other agencies' proceedings would be swept into this holding if the court were to decide this case on the ground that these particular proceedings are non-adversarial. And the petitioner's attorney at that point said maybe the Veterans Affairs, maybe the Railroad Retirement Board, but again seemed to be hanging a lot, at least from a practical standpoint, on the fact that, as Dick said, there are just a few hundred cases that would have to be reheard here. And so trying to kind of allay concerns, I think, from the court that a ruling for petitioner would really uproot agency proceedings and waste a lot of time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.